The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
Coming up next week, the European Commission and the Institute of International and European Affairs are co-organising a conference on trade and economic security in Dublin, focusing on competitiveness and economic security in Europe. And one of the people who is going to be central at that conference is the EU sanctions envoy, David O'Sullivan. He's with us this morning. David, good morning.
Good morning, Anton. How are you?
I am very good. David, many of the previous positions that you held, so whether they be Ambassador of the European Union to the US or Secretary General of the European Commission, they are the kind of things that people in the street would be able to infer what the role consisted of by the job title. Probably not the same with sanctions envoy. Can you explain in layman's terms what that is?
Yeah, very easily. I mean, my job is to reach out to those countries who are not applying our sanctions against Russia to deal with issues of circumvention of sanctions that may be happening in their jurisdiction. So if goods which previously were going to Russia are going to a third country and being re-exported from there to Russia, that's obviously a circumvention of our sanctions. And my job is to reach out to those third countries and discuss with them ways in which we can get them to prevent this kind of circumvention happening in their territory.
Do they welcome you reaching out? Because I assume if that is what is happening, there is a big economic incentive for them to allow it to continue.
You know, actually not. Very often these are products which are not made in those countries. There's little economic benefit. There's just the through flow. You know, if you're in Kazakhstan and suddenly people are shipping microelectronics through Kazakhstan to Russia, there's little gain for Kazakhstan. There's no benefit to them. So I find that countries are actually very open to looking at whether they can prevent this kind of trade. And we have succeeded with many countries in precisely persuading them to halt the flow through their territory of what we call battlefield goods. These are the microelectronics that tragically, you know, find their way into drones and missiles that are raining down on Kyiv. You saw last night some 600 attacks, 4 people killed again. And many of these components are actually of Western origin, and Russia is desperate to get hold of them. And we have succeeded, I think, in making that much more difficult and much more expensive.
How would you view the efficacy of the totality of the European sanctions against Europe thus far?
I would think that we, 3 years in, we have, you know, most of the significant indicators in the Russian economy are flashing red. The interest rate is 20%. They are struggling in the labor market. They're struggling with industry. The investment is completely down, except in the war economy. So basically what has happened is Mr. Putin is cannibalizing the civil economy to pay for and to run the war economy. Now, you can do that for a certain amount of time, but at a certain moment, your economic fundamentals don't add up. And I think that is very clearly the case in Russia. That's why we need to maintain the pressure of sanctions. We're just discussing another package of sanctions now, and we would hope to see further increases joined by our G7 partners as well. So I think they are having an impact. Of course, on their own, sanctions are not going to stop the war. That's clear. Nobody should be under any illusion. That requires military support to Ukraine, that requires political support to Ukraine. But the sanctions are a very, very important part of weakening Russia's war effort.
And do you or does anybody in the Commission or beyond model the predicted economic impact and when you think you might cross key thresholds? Do you have any sense of we expect X by Y?
It's difficult to be that precise. I'm an economist by training, Antoine, but I'm very skeptical when it's called a science, you know, because it is, and it's difficult to get accurate statistics out of Russia as well. We notice that they have started producing less reliable, less frequent statistics. But there are people following this very closely. The Finnish Central Bank is a key watcher of the Russian economy. They produce regular reports, and they confirm and underpin our argument that the Russian economy is struggling and it is getting more and more difficult. They've had to increase taxes, which Putin swore he would never do. So, you know, they are starting to struggle, and it's important to keep the sanctions in place and indeed to intensify that pressure.
Does that come with a threat? Because presumably the more cornered Vladimir Putin feels, the more aggressive he is likely to be.
Well, I mean, he is the aggressor in Ukraine. He has invaded Ukraine. He has invaded a sovereign country. You can't just sit back and take that, you know. So we have to push back. And he has to see that we are capable of pushing back and that we will not give him a free ride in his imperialist ambitions in Central Europe. So I think this is a very dangerous moment in European history. I think none of us thought we would ever be in this place, but that's the situation Mr. Putin has created. And unfortunately, it requires us to take some tough decisions and some tough measures against Russia, but also to improve our own defense capabilities. Because frankly, Mr. Putin believes in one thing only, that's force. And he only respects the force of the other side. So if he sees Europe as being vulnerable or weak in defense terms, he will say, well, I can make a move. So I think, unfortunately, we also have to increase our own defense capabilities in Europe in order to send a very clear message that we are not going to allow Mr. Putin rewrite the rules of engagement in Europe to be might is right and the person with the biggest army wins.
Now, that's created a number of challenges and a number of Rubicons have been crossed, particularly in Germany, that we didn't think were likely ever, if at least not for decades more. What's your take on the level of political and societal cohesiveness across the EU member states and its willingness and capacity to step up to the challenge that you're outlining?
Well, I'm part of we're a very privileged generation. We've lived peacefully. We thought the peace dividend of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the liberation of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe was the end of history. You know, it was the end of conflict. We thought we were, and we've benefited from that massive peace dividend. So it is a psychological change. You're quite right that we have to explain to people that unfortunately that can't continue in that way. We have to rebuild our military capabilities to push back and make it clear to Mr. Putin that he won't be able to invade. Now, I think in most countries, to be frank, it depends a bit where you live. The closer you are to Russia, the more you believe in that, right? You talk to the Baltic states, I mean, who've had their incursions in Estonia recently. They see the Russian threat as very, very real. You talk to Poland, the same thing. Obviously, when you get further west, and not to mention Ireland, people maybe are slightly less convinced because of the geography. But geography doesn't really protect you anymore in modern warfare. And we've seen the Russian overflights in our airspace. We've seen the attempts to mess around with the undersea cables. So unfortunately, there's no hiding place for any of us. You know, we all have to stick in this together as the European Union and show a display of force that will dissuade Mr. Putin from trying to use military force to further his aims.
And do you believe the capacity is there to do that? I mean, when you talk about things like investing in defense and investing in armament, so much of that is, well, has been provided directly by America or bought in through America, and America is showing itself less and less willing. Is there a European capacity to fill that vacuum?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, it will take a certain amount of time because we have been highly dependent on US kit. But I think there is a growing recognition that we need to develop these things together. European industry is gearing up to produce more. And I think we are capable of filling that gap. I think we're also capable of purchasing from other suppliers, not just the United States. I mean, other people produce these kinds of equipment that we need. So I think it'll be a mixture of diversifying our sources of supply, starting to make our own, and hopefully reaching a point in 4 or 5 years from now where we do have an autonomous capability for the key things which are needed. Also, the nature of warfare is changing. Look at the way that the drones have dominated the Ukraine battlefield. This was something unheard of, a few years ago. No one military weren't looking at that, but now Ukraine has become expert in dealing with these issues and in producing their own drones. So, you know, it's a rapidly moving picture, and we in Europe have to, figure out how we do this. We do it together. We do it, obviously, through NATO for those countries that are members of NATO. But we do need an autonomous European capability, military capability, if we are to stand on our own 2 feet, which, you know, it's very clear Mr. Trump believes we have to do.
And hand in hand with that, we need the economic strength to be able to fund all of it, which brings us to the Conference on Trade and Economic Security this week. The Draghi report was worrying in terms of European economic competitiveness, in terms of things like the level of IPOs that can be expected, in terms of innovation across the European Union. Has it been left to gather dust on a shelf, or do you see the effect of it in the bureaucratic machine?
No, I think everyone is very focused, and I'm sure Commissioner Šefčovič next week at the conference will give more detail on that. But I mean, the key thing in Draghi, I mean, there are many interesting things, but the key thing is that we need to further unlock the huge potential of the single market. I was around when we first created the single market, 1992. We all, you know, those of us who were around at the time remember that, and we did a very good job. But it's incomplete. There are many ways in which we need to make the market more integrated. You mentioned one which is very important, I think, which is finance for startups. We have a lack of liquid capital in Europe for our young entrepreneurs who want to build their companies from the 25 million, let's say, to the 100 million or the 200 million. Very often they have to go to America to get the liquid capital. So I think we have a very serious challenge of better integrating our capital markets and creating a real capital market for entrepreneurial activity, which is going to be crucial, especially with AI and all the other technological developments. So, no, I think people are looking very closely at the Draghi report, but this is not something, you know, that can be, it's not a light switch that you switch on or off from one moment to the next. It requires preparation. We've made proposals. The Commission has made proposals for the Savings and Investment Union to work on the creating a more liquid capital market, and all the other Draghi recommendations are being worked on. And I think this is something which is a very important challenge for Europe to put itself better in a better competitive position vis-a-vis our main competitors, and to leverage the huge benefit that is a single market of 450 million consumers. We are one of the top three economies in the world.
Although I've heard Mairead McGuinness speak on the Capital Markets Union when she was the commissioner responsible for it, and there was sort of shades of the Yes Minister joke about integrated ticketing, that it was a wonderful idea, but that nobody wanted to be landed with actually delivering it. Is it deliverable?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is. I mean, it does require some decisions that maybe, you know, will not be simple for some member states, because it does involve common regulation of the financial structures. 70% of our industry is funded by banks, 30% by liquid capital. In America, it's the opposite. 30% is funded by banks of industry and 70% is liquid capital. We need to get closer to the American numbers than to the numbers we have now. I think everyone understands this. There will be some resistance from vested interests throughout our member states, but I think the Commission is working very hard, and I think it will happen. And I think it is a hugely important development for our future competitiveness.
What do you think of the political environment across Europe in which all of this is happening? Because you cite the early 90s, you have been involved in European politics and bureaucracy since the 80s. There was that initial movement of cohesiveness and optimism and shared ideals. Is that still at the bedrock, or is that dissolving around us?
No, it is still there. And if you look at the Eurobarometer polls, support for the European Union, support for membership of the European Union still, you know, is still very high in all our member states. But of course, you know, when it comes down to taking some difficult decisions, you get reluctance and you get hesitation. But we've always managed. I mean, if you look at what happened with the pandemic when with COVID, you look at what happened with the Ukraine war. I mean, in the end, you know, Winston Churchill, I think, said you can rely on the Americans to do the right thing, but only after they've exhausted all the alternatives. It's a bit like it's a bit like that in Europe, right? We like to exhaust all the alternatives, and then we finally decide to do the right thing. So we're going through a bit of that at the moment, and there is, I mean, I acknowledge in the body politic throughout Europe there is a growing discontent, a sort of, you know, people don't like the status quo, and they're tending to vote for, you know, anybody anybody but the parties they voted for previously. So yeah, that's there, and we have to deal with that, and we have to engage with it and explain to people why the European project is still the only show in town for preserving our economic lifestyle, but also our social model and our social justice and our healthcare, free education, all the things that makes Europe such a great place to live.
And to what extent do you think that political shift, the anybody but the established parties, the sense of dissatisfaction, the sense of disenfranchisement, how much of that is naturally occurring, and how much of that comes back to where we started with cyber wars and the fomentation of aggression and dissatisfaction by direct state action?
Yeah, I mean, I like everyone, I just read the book Careless People by the lady, the whistleblower from Facebook.
Sarah Wynne Williams.
It's a read, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is a read. I mean, you know, there's some scores being settled, undoubtedly, but it is a bit scary to see some of the insights she gives to how social media can manipulate public opinion. So that undoubtedly is there. We know that social media has changed the sort of the public space, and I tend to agree with you that it seems to give a premium to anger and to venting rather than constructive suggestions, and maybe it actually augments that even beyond what would be naturally there. But, you know, we have to listen to people, and we have to understand why it is that they feel that their real concerns are not being addressed by the existing politics, and why they sometimes feel attracted by, frankly, much more extreme politics, which might not give very good outcomes at all. So that's a challenge we face across Europe. And I have great respect for the politicians who have to do that, because it's not simple.
But do you think that sense that there is an onus on them to do it is shared by those politicians?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, if you're a politician and you're out in your constituency and you're talking to people, you know, you sense the mood. So I think there is. I think there's a bit of a scramble to know exactly how you respond to some of these issues, and that's more complicated. But I think, you know, ultimately it's the survival of our democratic model, and you know, we've talked about the European way of life, but obviously democracy is key to that. But democracy is also about letting the people have their say and listening to that.
Can I ask you finally, David, about the, when it comes to trade and economic security, the relationship with the US? As I said, you spent several years as ambassador of the European Union to the US. What's the strategy in terms of that trade relationship? In the darkened rooms, is the belief, look, we just wait out the Trump administration and then things return to normal? Is there a level of normality to the relationship that happens behind the scenes? Where is all of that at?
Well, I don't think anyone believes you just wait out Trump, because we have no idea what will come in 2028. And if you look at the experience after Trump won, when Biden took over on trade, Biden did not seriously change many of the policies that Trump had put in place. So I think, unfortunately, because it's not very good news for us, I think we have to assume that the kind of trade policy President Trump is promoting in America will continue to be the sort of American approach to trade, even if Mr. Trump himself were to be replaced by somebody else. I mean, I think the Commission and von der Leyen have done a very good job in trying to make the best of a difficult situation, in reaching the agreement they did with President Trump on the tariffs. It's not perfect. You know, I myself would never thought we'd see ourselves having to agree to that, but it has brought some predictability, some stability. It has eliminated the talk of a trade war, which would frankly not have been in anyone's interest at this point. But we have to draw some lessons, and we have to figure out how we diversify. That's why we're looking to open other markets in Latin America with Mercosur. We've just concluded a deal with Indonesia. We're negotiating with India, and we hope to conclude a trade deal. trade deal with them. We've opened negotiations now with the Gulf, with the UAE. So I think a good part of our strategy has to be to diversify the markets we export to and not be maybe quite so reliant on the US as we've been in the past, because I do think the changes coming into the American trade policy are going to be with us for some time to come.
David, thank you very much for your time this morning. That is David O'Sullivan, who is EU sanctions envoy.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.